Chapter 23. December 21st. The Final Hours. On Abaddon. The Union. Wiley had realized that he was being dieseled when he saw that they were crossing the same sodden shopping street again. There were piles of yarn, there were farm implements, there were baskets and paintbrushes, and hatchets polished to a high shine. He might be a shapeshifter like the rest of them, but he was not on their side. No, he was a Union man. He had remembered that. They were right about him being an intelligence agent. He was, but not a very good one, given that he'd gotten his sweet ass caught just when that was the worst possible thing that could have happened. Wiley had examined every inch of the wagon, but it was made like a fricking safe. The goddamn driver would open a little hatch from time to time and shit and piss into it. Wiley stayed well back, but the place stank. He wondered if his own shit was yellow now, too. The wagon had been stopped for some time before he understood that it wasn't going to be moving again. There was a series of clicks, and the door went hissing open. Even in this place, with its dirty brown sky coming out, hurt his eyes. He was coming to the crisis of his failure now, he knew.
"Ready for lunch?" his captor said. "Your hands are coming to me and mine, I hear."
His hands. What a place. Trapped in the wagon with nothing to do but think, he had remembered more of his real life. If you looked, really looked, you wouldn't find a trace of Wiley Dale before December 26th, 1995, the day he'd made his transition into a human life that had been painstakingly constructed for him to enter. Wiley Dale had already been established as a novelist by the organization that had sent him to the human Earth, but the first book he'd written himself was Alien Days, his story of his abduction, which had actually been a looking-glass memory of his arrival on One Moon Earth. As Wiley's eyes adjusted to the light, he found himself standing before a gigantic version of a building familiar to him. It was the model for the tomb of Skull and Bones on the campus of Yale University, but the tomb was not large. This building was 200 feet tall, a great, ugly monolith. Compared to the rest of the city, which echoed with roars, screeches, discharges of steam, the rumbling of wagons, and various unidentifiable hoots, laughs, and howls, the silence here was total. Bones had been founded by William Huntington Russell, whose stepbrother Sam had carried opium into China for the British when they were trying to get back the gold they'd spent on Chinese tea. British captains hadn't been willing to do it. It might have been the 1850s, but drug running was still drug running. Russell had no problem with addicting the Chinese.
"Are you happy?" he asked his grinning captor.
"Yeah, I'm happy."
"Then fuck you.
Could I season your fingers?"
"You going to Two Moon Earth?"
"I should be so lucky. No can afford."
Wiley thought of the shithole the Seraph hordes were being sent to.
"What does it cost?"
"Whatever you have, which assumes you have something. They don't consider an artificial syrinx with a busted jaw in this old wagon worth a ticket. I live in it, you know, when it's not otherwise occupied."
"So you're poor?"
"Poor as shit, which is why..." He stopped.
He listened, so Wiley listened too. Keening came, heart-freezing, getting louder fast.
"Knees!"
Wiley didn't argue. As he went down to the hard earth and little knots of mushrooms like small exposed brains, a line of flying motorcycles with silver fenders ridden by figures in gold metallic uniforms and gleaming gold helmets and face masks came speeding out of the sky and hung dead still a foot or so above the ground, their motors revving as the riders worked to keep them stable. This was followed by a smooth whoosh of sound, and a jewel of an air car appeared. He knew who it belonged to, of course. Marshal Sampson. His escort bowed, and he bowed too.
There was a click, and he could sense somebody getting down, coming over.
"Hello, Wiley."
The voice positively bubbled.
"I knew it from the first. It had to be this. Actually, I'm impressed. I'll never tell her that, of course, but it was a brilliant operation."
"Thank you.
I just came from raping your wife, incidentally. Bring him."
He was kicked from behind and ended up scuttling through the huge doors, which had opened soundlessly and now presented the appearance of a gaping cave. As Wiley walked through the darkness of the anteroom and Samson opened the inner door for them both, the enormous golden floor struck him with a powerful sense of remembrance. That floor had been a source of scandal at home, a symbol to the union of the greed of the autocrats who ran this side of the planet. A tall woman, loaded with jewels, her hair sleek and white, dressed in the richest clothing Wiley had ever seen, came striding forward. Her face was so white that it glowed, the scales attractively tiny, the features delicate. He knew that this was the infamous leader of this world, Echidna, whose family had held controlling ownership of the corporation for uncountable millennia. All the females in the line were called Echidna. When one wore out, a new clone replaced it seamlessly without any public awareness. There was never an issue of succession, unlike the Union, which was a simple democracy and in turmoil all the time. "Come, spy," she said. "I want to gloat before dinner." As they crossed the great room, he saw Lee Raymond, Robert Mugabe, and Ann Coulter playing a game involving dice on what appeared to be a table made of emeralds, rubies, and a great gleaming expanse of pure diamond. He recognized the game. It was Senet, the Egyptian predecessor to backgammon. In the human worlds, the rules of Senet had been hidden away by the Seraph, but here, where they had not, players at Senet gambled for souls. He was not sure if they were human, or simply proud of their achievements as human and showing off their forms. "I had no idea your penetration of human society was so extensive." "But not of both human worlds, not as much as I hoped. This time around, we're only getting the one, I fear." She shot him a twinkling glance. "But we are getting it, you Union shit." Coulter now shifted into a sallow reptilian form with big, beady scales. Her black tongue darted behind spiked teeth made yellow from too much tobacco. Wiley realized that she was lusting after him. Mugabe, who was apparently her Seraph husband, scurried behind her, trying to keep a cloak around her. "Anne wants to bed you before we eat," Echidna said. "It's a particular pleasure of hers to fuck her food." They arrived at a tall window, curtained. "Open it," Echidna snapped at Samson. "I just want you to see this, Union man." Wiley realized that she had brought him close to a great black wall with huge levers on it. Scalar controls, he knew, that worked the gigantic lenses that were deployed on 2 Moon Earth. But then the curtains swept open, and he saw a lawn so bright green it must have been painted, awash in splendid people, some of them reptilian, others human, or seemingly so. There were politicians, of course, great grinning hordes of them, military officers in the uniforms of 12 countries, representatives of various royal families, rock stars, CEOs, television personalities, preachers, mullahs, gurus, in fact, every sort of human leader and person of power. Among them strolled naked Seraph girls and boys, their scales bleached so white they looked new-minted, carrying trays loaded with barbecued fingers, ears, and toes, and flutes of hissy champagne. To one side was a line of elaborate gas grills, all black and chrome. He recognized that they were Strathmores from home, the brand he had on his own deck, except that these were limousine models with 12 burners instead of the usual 4. Most of them were rolling spits, and on them some of the victims still twisted and squirmed. Behind each grill hung a complete body molt on a tall spike, a pale skin attesting to the youth and therefore tenderness of the person under preparation. Echidna pointed to an empty grill.
"That'll be you," she said.
He wanted to try to run, anything to avoid what seemed inevitable. But there was more, because he saw that this party was not to celebrate his capture. Or not only that, it was also to celebrate an enormous event that was unfolding in a valley behind the building. In the center of this valley was a gigantic circular lens of purest black, its surface reflecting the wan midday sun, and around it, stretching to every horizon, were what must be millions and millions of seraph, ready to pour through the moment the signal was given. He saw men, women, children, heard the booming of syrinxes, the chatter and whoops of other animals, and above it all the excited, argumentative shrieking of the seraph themselves as they jostled for position and accused one another of trying to break the baskets of black, oblong eggs the women all carried. He assumed that he would die here today. He'd been living for years in an extremely dangerous situation with a wiped memory, and that made you vulnerable. So vulnerable, in fact, that it was probably just a matter of time before you ended up going through the funny little door in the woods. He loved his poor family, though, his striving, brilliant, lovely family. What would happen to them? Could they shift, he wondered? Did they, perhaps in secret, the children under their covers at night, Brooke in the privacy of her early mornings? Anne had sidled closer, and he thought maybe he could cause a little confusion. In this class-ridden society, she was bound to have some prerogatives. Time wasn't on his side, obviously, but distraction might be. He turned to her.
"Must I?"
She squared her shoulders.
"Of course you must."
He went toward her, and thus also toward the wall behind her.
"Guards," Echidna said mildly, "stay with him."
Samson came, and with him his heavily armed escort. Wiley was still bound, of course, but he came to Ann Coulter and looked down at her. Her scales fluttered and surged, and a black substance that smelled of sulfur began to ooze from under her eyelids.
"Ann," her husband hissed, "you're compromising yourself."
She was really steaming. She loved a man in bondage, that was clear. Wiley saw that he had a moment, and only one, and it was this moment. He opened his mouth and drew his tongue along the backs of his teeth in the best imitation of a whore that he could imagine. She tittered. Her breath had in it the flat muskiness of death.
"Will somebody please remove these children?" Mugabe shouted.
A number of them had foregathered to watch the fun.
"Part of their education," Echidna said.
Her husband now joined her. Wiley had forgotten the name of this huge being, but he was peerlessly imposing in his sleek black suit with his shimmering skin and brilliant, watchful eyes. Another ancient ruler, riding the ages on a foam of clones. He tilted his head and felt Coulter's kiss invading his mouth like a soaked chaw of somebody else's tobacco. With all the power in him, his every muscle singing, his whole heart and soul and mind devoted only to this one movement, he sprang upward. These lizard forms were not as earthbound as human bodies. They didn't feel as much either, not pain, not love, not pleasure. But they were ferociously strong, and he was strong. He had kept himself well, understanding now the obsessive hammering away he had done at Gold's in Wichita. He'd scared people, the way he would swim laps like a machine. He hadn't known why his body was like this, just that he needed the swimming, the running, the boxing, the karate, all of it, needed it and devoured it. The guard had made one mistake early on. He'd seen him as human and bound him as human, careful of the delicate skin of a much more fragile creature than a seraph. He ripped his arms free with ease. Unfortunately, the gun had gone. They'd left it with him only to amuse themselves with his disappointment when it was taken.
"These sell for a nice price," the guard had said as he removed it.
For a moment, there was nobody between him and the great control panel. He grabbed a lever, pulled it, grabbed another, did the same. The action was so damn satisfying that he growled, he screamed as he pulled another and another. Echidna roared. Her husband, Beleth, that was the name, leaped toward him and came crashing into Mugabe, who threw himself into his path. Samson turned, and Ann Coulter slashed him with a molting hook, drawing his skin open and revealing the muscles beneath. He shrieked in agony. It felt good to draw off dry molt, of course, but raw like this, it was torment. Coulter, Union. Her human disguise was brilliant, a spokesman for the aims of the corporation so extreme that she made them look ridiculous. Wiley leaped, giving Beleth a head kick that he could feel smash the skull. Gabbling, his brains flying, he pitched back into his own onrushing guards.
"Samson's air car!" Ann shouted.
"Go!"
"It's ensouled!"
"Of course it is, you damn fool! Go!"
There was a whispering crackle, and Ann flew into a thousand red chunks. One of the guards now turned his weapon toward Wiley, who hit the floor as he pushed Echidna into the line of fire. Her legs and bottom half, spurting fountains of blood, ran a few steps and collapsed at the feet of the surprised guard, while the top half, which had hit the floor smack on its bloody waist-level base, uttered whistling gasps, waved its arms, and tore at its hair as shrieking, laughing children who had mistaken the whole thing for a game surrounded it, running in and pinching and squealing and then running away. As Wiley crossed the floor, he heard the snicker of more guns. Then a dozen outriders came swinging down from above on webs like thick ropes dripping with glue. But he was outside now, and the air car was waiting there, its now unattended motorcycle escort lined up neatly on the ground. He kicked them over and dove into the interior. Expecting the car to resist the entry of what would be a known enemy, he yanked the door down with all his might.
"Hello, brother," the car said.
And the voice hit Wiley with a shock like freezing water and the joy of the first morning of the world. He hadn't heard his brother speak aloud in over 30 years, but he recognized his voice instantly. When Wiley was just a tiny boy, his beloved older brother had been killed by corporation marauders and his soul kidnapped. His brother had been a great soldier. They'd kept his Medal of Valor and his various orders in a glass case in the family room, proud mementos. Wiley had gone to the human world because it took courage, and he wanted to show that he also had the ability to fight well for the Union. They swept into the air.
"Brother," he said, "did they steal your soul?"
The car did not answer, and a flash of unease went through him. Abaddon was a place of deceptions, so maybe. But then he looked down at what they were circling, and saw that the lens below him was now surrounded by as vast a crowd as he had ever seen. But things were not going well. The blackness of it had turned angry red, and it was boiling like a lava pool, and the surging crowd, in trying to escape, was instead falling in from all sides. Smoke and steam rose from the massive pyre.
"Are they dying?" Wiley asked. "I think they're going through, but it's not right. It's very not right.
Brother, has your soul been trapped in this car all this time?"
"Hell no. I stole the car yesterday. I've got a lot of bodies. I use them like scuba gear to dig into the physical whenever I need to, and..."
Uh-oh. There was an angry rattle against the vehicle, which proceeded to shoot upward so fast that Wiley blacked out momentarily. When he came to, flashes were speeding past the windows.
"Pulse, Strider," his brother said.
This was a weapon that delivered pulses of discrete, super-excited electron plasmas that could instantaneously incinerate a car like this.
"Fly me, brother."
"Me? I don't know how."
"You were a hell of a pilot as a boy."
"How could you know? You were dead."
"I'm an operative, just like everybody else in the family. They were tricked into believing they'd captured my soul."
Mean red light filled the car, and it tumbled wildly through the air.
"Brother, I need you to remember your piloting skills. Do it now."
The words caused memory to flood Wiley's mind of being at the controls of a machine like this, of handling the twin sticks, of firing its weapons at sky targets, of having a glorious time in mock dogfights and evasion training. He'd expected to be a pilot, but his aptitude tests were what had gotten him dragooned into intelligence. That, and he now also realized, the fact that his brother was already an agent. He remembered it all now, his whole life as a Union kid, his training, and something so poignant that he could almost not bear the recollection. He'd had a girl. He'd married her. He had a wife here on Abaddon, in the Union, the one good place that remained. The car rattled. There was a flash, and this time the cabin filled with smoke and the fire alarm started.
"Fly me."
Wiley gripped the controls. He swung the car from side to side, spotted the telltale sparkle of the Pulse Strider installation on the ground. He turned hard, thrust the nose down, opened the throttle, and slammed both sticks hard over. The car shot like a diving eagle straight toward the installation. Pulses poured out. They would be forced to go on continuous triangulation, and his random jigging of the controls meant that not even he was sure of the trajectory. He was nearly on top of them when they began to try patterns. Now, this was bad. This might work for them.
"Are you unarmed?" he asked his brother. "Of course I'm unarmed. I'm a sports car."
"Just asking. Hold on."
"My keel hurts. I can feel my keel going."
If an insoluble machine's nervous system was properly designed, the soul inhabiting it would sense it the same way it did a body. Wiley leveled out. He was now speeding across open land, directly towards some Aristo's hunting estate. It was fashionable. He could see the house like something out of the English countryside. His brother said,
"I see 12 bogeys coming down on us."
Wiley went into the forest among the trees.
"You'll wreck me."
He took some advice from Martin's son, Trevor. "Just let yourself happen." His hands moved as they shot down a forest path, then up a stream. This far from the city it wasn't so polluted, not even on the corporation side, where mentioning global warming drew a death sentence. But then again, practically everything drew a death sentence. Executions were not only a form of population control, they kept the masses both entertained and fed. Then he saw a wall. The wall. The one the corporation had built around the Union. It was gray, immense, and dead ahead. He pulled back on the sticks and hopped it, and suddenly, everything changed. Here were fields of swabe and borogrove, and orchards full of trees heavy with lascos and spurls and nape. Everything was green. The sky was dusty blue rather than dirty brown, and he knew that there would be stars at night. A few stars. Here, it was illegal not to mention global warming.
"I'll take me back," his brother said.
"Yeah, since I don't know where I'm going."
"I'm pulsing our code, but we could get a look-see from the Air Force, so if we do, don't take evasive action. We are home, brother."
Wiley's heart ached as he watched the rich green Union land speed below them. Home. And look at the houses. He could even see pretty shutters. Most Unionists farmed. He had farmed, and he could see that the harvest was still coming in here and there. Harvest is late.
Winter's late,
It's too warm. If only an eighth of the planet fights the good fight, we can't win. We can only lose slowly. The Gulf Stream stopped for 4 months this year. Avalon nearly froze, while here in Aztlan, most of the maize crop burned. What about the corporation? They must be feeling it too. Farming's illegal there now. He paused for a long time. I suppose you noticed what they're eating.
I noticed.
They came down on a pebbled driveway before a modest old sandstone, its worn carved serpents of luck and joy barely visible in its ancient walls. But this was home, all right, a place he now realized that he had felt as an absence in his spirit for his whole time away. He got out.
I wish you could come in, brother.
When this tour is over, I go back to my natural body forever, and I am looking forward to that, Wiley.
I don't want to rattle around in the house alone.
The arched wooden door opened. A figure stood back in the shadows, one lovely tapering claw on the door jamb. Oh, it was impossible.
Talia? Actriel?
Yes?
His response was so automatic that it required no thought. Actriel was his real name, and he was a Department of Defense information officer. After pilot training, his work had been involved in the issuance of directives and proclamations, and he'd been sent to the human world because of his writing ability and his communications skills. As she came out into the light, the car's horn beeped twice, and it took off into the sky, turned, then raced back toward corporation territory. For a moment, Actriel watched it go, watched sadly, wishing that his brother would come out, understanding why he could not bear to live in the freedom of his real body even for a short time, only to have to return to that miserable thing and go back to his hellish work. She came to him, her eyes lowered, tears flowing. He took her in his arms, and truly, he was home again, and from such a far, far place. I'd forgotten everything, he said. She nodded against his shoulder. But where's your husband, Talia? Your family? Surely you have one. It's been years. Arm in arm, they went into the dim, comfortable interior of the house. Memory flooded him as he walked into the broad central room with its white walls and sky-blue ceiling and the climbing flowers painted everywhere. His mother's hearth was here, his father's tall harvest boots still by the closet where he'd always kept them. Beside them, smaller, shorter boots. When he'd waited for the tender swabe, he'd worn them.
Do you still farm?
It will always be a farm.
Of course.
The union's goal of environmental balance meant that changing land use patterns was not done without major reason. She took his hand.
Do you want me?
He threw his arms around her, felt her heart beating against his. This love, how had he ever managed to leave it? She was his dear, dear one, the alpha and omega of his soul. When he could have farmed here forever and never left her side, why had he ever gone? Then he remembered his little Kelsey and proud, strong Nick, children of two worlds, his kids. And they were out there on the front line with their mom, and if he stayed here, they would be abandoned. It was as hard a moment as he had ever known. The beauty of his wife was stunning, her scales so tiny and so pale that she looked like a doll, her hair a wisp of delicate white smoke around her head, her eyes bluer than a fine earth sky, and deeper than the deepest ocean. How he loved this woman, his friend of his youth and childhood, his dear companion. But there were vows of the lips and vows of the blood,
And his vow to those children on One Moon Earth was a vow of the blood. "I'm so glad it's over," she said. She gazed into his eyes. The Corporation Seraph were remembered by man as Nephilim, or Archons, as demons. Mankind called Union Folk angels, or Daikini, sky dancers.
"I'm glad it's over, too."
"But you sigh, husband." He drew her close to him. These were simple houses, a central great room with kitchen, dining, and storage in one wing and sleeping quarters in the other. They had been living in these houses forever, almost literally. They had no age, nothing here did. The union was with God. There was nothing to count. But he had forgotten how good a woman's hair could smell, sprinkled as hers was with the dust of flowers. It fell sometimes on that brilliant, glowing brow that was almost as soft as human skin. She was almost as beautiful as Brooke, really. But the truth was that even to Seraph, the humans were incredibly beautiful. It was why corporation types had gone to rape them in the first place. It was why Unionists cherished and protected them as best they could. There was something about the humans that was close to God, very close, and you felt toward them both a desire to protect and a desire to worship. Kelsey, Nick, Brooke, his buddy Matt, cigars and absinthe. The fun of it all, of being in the human form, of looking like them and being able to kiss human lips and walk their pretty streets, to look up into the sacred blue of their skies, to lift his face to clean rain and listen to wind in the night, to watch TV, to go to the movies and eat popcorn, to feel warm human hands on his human skin, to sink into the dark of her. "You're far away," Talia said. "I'm just in shock, seeing you again, remembering you, realizing... Oh, my Talia, all that I've forgotten." He took her again, held her close. "All that I've missed." She saw the truth, though. She knew him so well. They had been children together, born in the same basket, their eggs warmed by the same egg ladies. Their families had entwined their destinies long before they were born. Trying to hide his tears, he turned away from her. "I belong to you," he said, feeling the twin pulls of his fiercely divided loyalties. Again he hugged her, and again felt Brooke's absence in his arms. Her eyes met his. The question that flickered in them now was a dark one. Then she held up her hand. Her electrum ring glowed softly, his ring. He took her hand and kissed it. She laughed a little, deep in her throat, and he wanted her. He wanted her so badly that he began to exude from under every scale on his neck. She brought a towel and wiped it gently. Her hands, touching him, evoked desire so great that it seemed beyond his trembling flesh, beyond belief, beyond body itself, a longing that was literally fantastic. But if he did this, then he could not leave her. Not a second time. It was too cruel. And yet he had the children, the vow, and the other dear wife. And he knew, as soon as he was with Brooke again, he would lose himself in the wonders of human life and human love. "It's only a few minutes," she said softly. She drew up the wooden blinds, and he saw in the evening light a diamond hanging in midair. In its facets, he could see another house, lights just coming on in the windows, and a small form at one of those windows looking out. Kelsey was waiting for her daddy to come back. "I have that permanent salve," she said. choose. He took her hands. We always knew the danger of the mission. I have a life there now. I have children who need their father. And he wished. He just wished. You won't remember me. You'll find somebody else, he said. Don't mock my love, please. He would leave her forever wanting him. If only he had known it would be this hard. He had known. She had known. She began to apply the salve, and he let her. It sank deep into him, into the most secret corners of his deepest cells. And as it did, this old homestead began to look stranger and stranger. He noticed that blinds closed up here, that there were no chairs, but only these strange three-legged stools. He saw the spinning wheel and the loom, ancient and obviously heavily used, but who used looms nowadays? And the grate, and the big iron cookpot, so strange and archaic, and candles instead of electric lights, also just plain weird. But then she did an odd thing. She applied salve to herself. But no, you mustn't. Look, the sun is setting, and Kelsey's got to be getting scared, and Nick's liable to blow our heads off if we come up in the dark. Brooke? Yes? Hello? Talia had been with him all along. Now, as they changed from seraph to human, fixed by the DNA salve, he threw his arms around her. It's you. It's always been you. Did you know? Not until I followed you through Samson's little gateway, then I knew. But you escaped from the corporation, you came home, you came to meet me, even though you could have stayed back. To protect you. Remember what I am. The Guardian Clan. He laughed a little. You really are a guardian angel. Who you need, Mr. Drinker and Smoker and Hell-Raising Daredevil. The idea that any sane person would volunteer for an assignment like this. It had to be done. Which is why I love you so. She smiled up at him, and as she did, her face shimmered, the scales smoothing in blurry waves, the brow widening, the cheeks growing less narrow, the eyes deeper, less wide, more human, the nostrils opening more, the lips softening and becoming red, the teeth thickening into human teeth. And he could feel by his own internal shivering that he was doing the same. This was not shape-shifting. This was fundamental DNA transformation. When his brother ended his tour of duty, this would be his house. He would re-enter his old body here. He would find his wife and bring her here. And there would be eggs here. And the egg ladies would brighten the house with their laughter again in the coming years, in the ages. But Talia and Actriel were dying into the human form. She took his hand more firmly. Ready? How do I look? Perfect. Or no, you're missing that mole under your left ear. Who's gonna notice? You know your daughter. She's inherited your following and watching instincts. Do we need to take salve for them? Born of Earth as they were, they have the DNA to shift, but not the skill. They'll stay as they are, with their good seraphim hearts in those lovely human forms. Are you going to be on my case again? Always. Then they were in their familiar woods, and for a fleeting moment his soul was in both worlds. Brooke said, I've got something on the tip of my tongue. He shook his head. I feel like I just woke up from a dream I thought I'd never forget. Which was? I forget. She came to him and kissed him. We've all been through too much, and it has to end. It ends here. She looked toward the house. It's time to return to normal life. Can we? I think we can. I mean, Have you noticed that it's 6 and nothing's happened yet? No 2012 shift here. The moon was yellow in the eastern sky, coming toward full now, rising in splendor. They both fell silent, and both for the same reason. Why are we out in the woods, Wiley?
We're...
He stopped. Why were they out here?
I came looking for you, he said at last.
That's it. And I came to find you.
I was in the cave.
Well, we're here.
I feel like I was on Mars or something, a million miles away.
Suddenly she threw herself on him. In the gathering dark, he felt very alone. Odd. Homesick, even. But for where?
His house was a quarter of a mile away, his only house.
I think our kids are going to be missing us, she said.
They headed up the hill.
The love that is so great that it cannot be seen, that seems not even to exist, but is in fact the silent binding that confirms the world, followed them, lingering close, as if to enjoy the warmth of what they had found together.
Where have you guys been? Nick yelled as they came up out of the woods. It's getting darker and darker around here.
I got lost, Wiley said.
And he got found.
You got lost? How? I thought you'd been killed.
Nick threw his arms around his father, and Wiley felt his surging youth and his love for his dad, and then Kelsey's also, from farther down by his knee, holding Barish up like an offering to her household god. As he entered with his children into the calm light, he heard the calling of another father, whose desperation began pouring into his mind the moment he was inside the house. He remembered the book, and Martin and Trevor, and their quest to recapture their invaded world. I've got work to do, he said. Nick followed him upstairs.
They're in terrible trouble, he said.
Then he added, I've written some. Wiley stopped. He turned to his son.
Oh?
Do you imagine that I don't know what I am, Dad? After what I've been through? What I've done for you?
He looked at his son. He thought, as if for the first time, what are you?
What we are as a family. We're not the same, Dad. We're in communication with other worlds. We have powers, and I know it, and you can't say otherwise. That's why they tried to kill us, and why they failed. I defended us too, Dad, and I'm owed.
Owed what?
You have to take me into your confidence, and you will never go into a gateway again like that without me to help you.
A memory flashed of a cottage in the woods. Funny memory, like a dream. Less than a dream, just a daytime imagining. The stuff of a story, no more.
The solstice is coming, and Martin and Trevor need us, Dad. But you're like lost in your own mind all of a sudden, and right now is the worst possible time for you to lose the thread.
He paused. Actually, I've written a lot. I've written the entire story of what you and Mom just did on Abaddon and who you are, and you can read that later, because right now we have a huge emergency, and Dad, there is no time. He went into the office. From downstairs, Brooke called.
What's going on?
Nick just wrote his first short story.
He sat down at the laptop.
Talia, he said. It's a beautiful name. But who's this Actriel? You've got to find a better name than that.
Dad, you'll read that later. Right now it's time to write, because when you do write, something new is going to happen.
Nothing's there. I can't write. Nick grabbed his hands, thrust them onto the keyboard.
Do it!
After a moment, there was a whisper in his mind. He typed a few words.
Trevor, Dad, you need to write about Trevor.
It was as if lightning had blasted him and shattered him, and he had a vivid image of a vast room lit by a curiously affecting, even disturbing, glow, a light that was blue and very alive, and communicated more clearly than any scream that it was in terrible trouble. His fingers moved on the keys, then sped. "At last," Nick said. "Trevor, buddy, listen up." Wiley was at his desk, but at the same time in another place, deep underground, and there was heard as another voice. And the seventh angel poured out his vial into the air, and there came a great voice out of the temple of heaven, from the throne, saying, "It is done." But it was not done, not for the seven people who were struggling in that dark underground hell for their lives and the life of an entire world. "There's a gateway down there, and they don't see it, Dad."
"I know."
"Then write it. Say where it is, if you know." "But they can't come here. They can't read this. Just do it." Silently, in the dark of the great cavern where Martin and his little band struggled to break the soul traps, the hidden gateway to Abaddon slid slowly into focus and began to open.